I call this House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, February 9th, 2024, and the time is 1:32 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Grunberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Shelby with the Juneau LIO and Sophia with House Records. The following members we have present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Carpenter, Representative Groh, Representative Sumner, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a full committee to do business. On today's agenda, we have two items on the calendar to bring back: House Bill 161 by Representative Wright and House Bill 67 by the Governor. First item on our agenda is House Bill 161, Civil Legal Services Fund by Representative Wright in its second hearing. We will hear public testimony and then set the bill aside. So I'd now like to open public testimony for Committee Substitute House Bill 161. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Please come to the table, state your name for the record. You will have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Vance. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of Civil Legal Services, a topic I feel very passionate about, and happy to be here on a snowy day. My name is Christine Pate. I am the Legal Program Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I know that many of you know who we are, but for those of you who don't, we're the statewide coalition of 24 domestic violence and sexual assault programs across the state, from Homer to Anchorage to Utqiagvik to Ketchikan. For the last 25 years, I have been running our program, providing civil legal services to survivors around our state who need help leaving the violence in their lives. We rely at our program on staff, volunteer, and contract attorneys. We are a small program. We are serving the state of Alaska with 3 people, three attorneys and 2 paralegals, and otherwise we rely on volunteers and contract attorneys, because our partner, Alaska Legal Services, and the other few agencies who do this work just do not have the resources to do it. Prior to my work, I was a legal services attorney in Fairbanks. I understand that there's an enormous continuing unmet need for Alaskans to access civil legal assistance, that there's few agencies in addition to ALSC that provide this service, and that those of a few of us that do it are working in partnership to be as efficient as we can. In the criminal justice system, there's a right to counsel. There is no corresponding right in the civil justice system. Survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking go into our courts every day without legal assistance. Court system statistics have shown that for a civil protective order, probably the first contact that a survivor might have with the justice system, only 10% of those cases have an attorney involved. Conversely, I know how critical civil legal services are to ending domestic violence and sexual assault for survivors. And surprisingly, it has been found to be the most important service to ending violence for a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. So, another minute.
I apologize. That was louder than I thought. Please continue, but wrap up shortly so we can give others equal time.
I will do so. Thank you. More important than the criminal justice system, with no offense to our important partners in the criminal justice system, because you have the critical tools that a survivor needs. If we know that a survivor stays in a relationship because they're afraid that they are going to be more harmed, leaving a relationship is the time of highest lethality. It is a civil legal attorney who can get you a protective order to leave a relationship. Survivors are told that they will lose custody of their children, that they will not be able to gain custody if they leave. It's a civil legal attorney who has to go and get custody. Survivors don't have the economic means to leave or the housing to leave. It's a civil legal attorney who can get spousal support, child support, a proper property division, make sure that they stave off an eviction for a survivor. That is what a civil legal attorney can do that can help people leave these relationships. We also have to say no many too many times when people come to us. Each week we do a case review in our office with the survivors who have come. I would say 1 in 2 times we have to say, sorry, we just do not have the resources. It is the same in Alaska Legal Services. So please give us the resources. I wanted to just end quickly with a story that an advocate in Anchorage told me about. We had placed her case with, or a case from a client that had come to her with an attorney, and it was a protective order case, and she said there was such a face of relief from the survivor when they knew that they were not going to go into court alone, facing their abuser in court, having to cross-examine the person who had just abused them, that they had an attorney there to help them. So please do pass House Bill 161 and give us the resources we need to do these cases and give them to Alaska Legal Services. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Vice Chair Allard has a question for you.
Yes. Thank you. I've had a lot of people contact me very concerned about the need for the increase, and some of the tenant landlord or whatever, those who have a low income that come in and with landlord issues. So you're asking for from a 10% to a 25% increase, correct?
Correct.
Could you tell me where the pockets of money that you have currently, where do you get all your funds? So besides us, where are other funds, and do you have a total?
Yeah, so I'm not a legal services employee, so I cannot speak for Alaska Legal Services. Oh. We're a separate legal services agency. I will tell you that we are almost 100% federally funded. We receive no money from the state of Alaska. And we rely, as I said, on volunteer attorneys who graciously give their time because there are not enough resources in this area. Last year, I believe we had $600,000 of in-kind services donated from the community of Alaska lawyers.
Could you, may I
follow up?
Thank you. Through the chair, could you tell me how much you guys received federally through the state?
We receive a legal assistance to victims grant through the federal government, and I'm just reapplying for that currently. We partner with two other civil legal providers, and that's $750,000. Doesn't go directly to our agency, all of that. We receive some VOCA funding through the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We receive...
Is that separate than the $750,000?
That is.
Could you... Well, it's a lot right now.
I would be happy to get that back to you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Payne.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your work.
Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, I will now move online. And I will try to get this name right. It's Jeannie Gerhardt-Saris. If you could state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
For the record, my name is Jean Gerhardt-Saris from Kiana, and I am a member of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, which supports the funding increase for Alaska Legal Services. And, I'm here to testify in support of increased funding. This benefits people with developmental disabilities, specifically in helping them gain services, maintain employment in the event that they're wrongfully discharged from employment, and to make sure that they're getting the benefits that they need to be full members of the community. It also benefits, of course, people with low incomes and people with other disabilities that have no access to legal support because they cannot afford their own attorney. I recently worked with an individual who is an adult and was involved in a civil matter. Everyone told the individual that most people just handle it by themselves. Well, most people are not dealing with disability, and this impacts their ability to understand and process information. I will say that Alaska Legal Services, and I've talked with people at Ukiagik, Nome, and Kotzebue, were extremely helpful and also sure that we had the information that I could support this individual with the information that the individual needed, because not being a support person does not mean you know about all the legal system. And people who need this service and can't afford it should not be put in a disadvantage in the courtroom. And Alaska Legal Services helps level that playing field. Thank you, and please support Alaska Legal Services. There has not been an increase, my understanding is, since 1984. And as the previous speaker said, there's not enough funds to serve everybody. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mary Ruth Moore from Wasilla. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Mary Ruth Moore, and I am in support of Bill 161. Alaska Legal Services has helped my 4 children and I for the last 5 years. They aided in keeping the domestic violence protection order extended to keep us all safe. Having the legal help we needed is what made me stick to the decision of no more physical, sexual, and emotional mental abuse. Without their help, we would very likely be dead. They also helped with custody and visitation for the divorce case. After our family went through carbon monoxide poisoning, we were also in need of another attorney, and they got Beth Chapman out of Juneau to help us with trust accounts for the children and I, and I was so grateful for that. Then when my dad died, we needed help enforcing his will correctly. Alaska Legal Services stepped in again. Our medical benefits were fought for by Alaska Legal Services as well, with last fall when they canceled a bunch of benefits for most of the Alaskan people that were on food stamps and Medicaid. They stepped in again and helped restore our benefits, and I am so grateful. I think they do need an increase because I know that I'm not the only one out there with these types of legal cases where one just goes into another and to another. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Trottle Hackley, Alaska Legal Services Corporation. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hello, my name is Trudell Hackley. Chair Vance, Vice Chair Allard, distinguished members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to speak today regarding HB 161. I appreciate you giving my voice a chance to be heard. I am a survivor of domestic violence. I was academically a gifted student admitted to college at 13 years of age. I met my now ex-husband in 1999 and very slowly started losing my spark, my autonomy, my free will, and my voice to advocate for myself during our 20-year relationship. I endured for my vows to God, my faith, and my children. It was only when I could no longer physically keep my ex-husband away from our children while he was brandishing a firearm that I left. One afternoon while he was gone, I took our clothes, their toys, and my car. That was it. That was all we left with. See, my ex-husband was and is a felon under DOC supervision with a personality disorder, hallucinations, multiple substance abuse issues, and a penchant for weapons. But at the time, he was also a business owner with means, and I was not. I believed getting out of the marriage and getting a protective order would be simple. All I wanted was safety and peace for my family. We had been through so much. When I started attending those court hearings, the years of silence and fear stole my voice. I was bombarded by vile accusations, continuances, and testimony by people I had never met. Excuse me. I sought help at Alaska Legal Services Corporation and was given representation. My lawyer helped me sort out all of the civil implications, motions, responses, ways to provide supporting documentation, and most of all, she gave me a voice. I obtained full custody of my boys, a long-term protective order, and a structure for supervised parenting time with their dad. Everything we needed to begin our lives anew. Everything we needed to sleep safely at night. Some nights with a window cracked and only one lock on the door. Something we hadn't had in 20 years. But not everyone is so blessed. It is hard to get representation through legal aid, and it is a lengthy process because, honestly, there just aren't enough lawyers. Funding is so low, the majority of people are turned away. Many qualify. A few get through the process, and even fewer have their case selected based on serious listed need. When a domestic violence victim seeks help and protection and their voice is not given equal access to the judicial system, it's a tragedy, often affecting a person, a family, a legacy for years. Please vote in favor of HB 161.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hackley. Next, we have John Peterson of Juneau. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, John Peterson here, J-O-H-S-P-E-P-E-R-S-O-N. I'm in support of funding Alaska Legal Services. I was a client of them and still am. They helped me to discuss with me for 5 years. And lady that I was seeing at the time, Heather, she really helped me out because I was having, I am certainly seeing a psychiatrist and have been a psychiatrist since 2006. And I went to the doctor, and then it was found that it was so bad that I couldn't do any work. I had a safety issue. Maybe it had, you know, stuff. But I went to Legal Services for help to see if I can get surgery, and they helped me out. And I did wind up getting disability with the help of Legal Services. I almost say that because this is my first time ever doing this. And I think my third year that I was going to be up there. I had tried before to get an attorney outside the state of Alaska, or even a financial to call me from Juneau, and they wanted to take it as a private attorney. They either said that I wouldn't qualify, or either said that I couldn't afford the fund. So I said that to do it for me so much. And so one of my family members mentioned Legal Services because I didn't know they were even meant to help people with disabilities. And so I went to Legal Services. And they helped me out to get my disabilities all messed up. But maybe at the end, my mother, she really helped me out. And I think it was she talked me into keep trying.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Peterson.
Okay. Thank you.
Next, we have Suki Miller from Anchorage. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes. Sounds like they are not on, and I believe that completes our public testimony for House Bill 161. Want to give just a second to make sure we didn't lose anyone. Okay, I will now close testimony on House Bill 161. For those watching online who did not have an opportunity to testify, you can email written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be uploaded to the public record. I will now set House Bill, actually before I do that, do members have any questions about House Bill 161? Seeing none, I will now set it aside and would like to remind members once again that the amendment deadline for this bill is tonight at 5 p.m. to my office. For our second agenda item, we will continue the amendment process for House Bill 67. Harassment, sex offenders, and offenses by the governor as presented by Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its fifth hearing. We will now continue with amendments for House Bill 67. At the last hearing, the committee adopted Amendment Number 1, sponsored by myself. And we will now move to Amendment Number 3 by Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, I move Amendment 3.
There's been an objection. Representative Gray, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what this amendment does is it raises the age of consent for sexual activity in Alaska from age 16, where it currently is, to age 18. The reason why this is important is that under the law, all teens are currently considered minors, except for in the cases of sexual activity, including sexual assault. Because the age of consent is 16, a 16-year-old is treated the same as a 35-year-old if they have been assaulted. The entire issue of the crime is no longer about protecting a vulnerable minor from a predatory adult, but about establishing whether or not consent can be proven. The difference is, as the statute currently stands, the 16-year-old is investigated. It must be determined that she did not consent. She is questioned differently by law enforcement. She is subject to a different physical exam than a 15-year-old would be. She must undergo an invasive pelvic exam, probably her first. This change means, if this change were to come into effect, we know the crime occurred. If a 40-year-old had sex with a 16-year-old, a crime has occurred. They will be afforded the same protections that any other minor would be afforded. Many other states have an age of 18 as the age of consent. I'll name just a few: Arizona, Florida, Idaho, Utah, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, North Dakota. They all are age 18. We would be in alignment with them. There are many folks in Alaska who are unaware that our age of consent is 16, but I'll tell you who's definitely aware of it. Any parent who has a 16 or a 17-year-old who they believe is being manipulated by an older adult. When they try to seek a protective order for their child, they are told that they cannot, that the child whether would have to seek that on their own. What this law does is protect our youth. I mean, this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions from committee members. Vice Chair Allard.
I'm not really sure how to phrase this. I don't know if I go to the sponsor. Do we have any legal or anybody on?
We have Lieutenant Robert French, Lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers, available online. And he may be able to answer some questions.
Can you, Lieutenant Roberts?
Lieutenant French.
Oh, Lieutenant French. Lieutenant, through the chair, Lieutenant French, this is Representative Allard. My question is, could you tell me if the legal age of marriage, is that 16? For clarification, please.
Through the chair, I am not exactly sure.
Oh, Casey's here. Is she?
Let me take a brief at ease. Back on the record, please state your name for the record and if you could answer the question.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair to Vice Chair Allard, I have to confess that I am a criminal attorney. I do not know the legal marriage age in Alaska. I will tell you, though, that the sexual abuse of a minor statutes do have a defense. It is an affirmative defense if at the time of the offense, the person was married to the offender.
Brief at ease.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, I want to see if you know this answer. Do you have the legal definition of a minor for the state of Alaska? If you don't, that's fine. We can move on and it's okay.
Through the chair to Vice Chair Allard, we don't know that there is a legal definition in statute per se. Generally, we use the term minor and juvenile interchangeably to mean somebody under the age of 18.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. That's it. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's probably something you could check quickly. I think that the law in Alaska on marriage is 18 without parental consent and 16 with parental consent. It's the minimum age. I think that could be checked, and I think that we're not really talking, or at least I wasn't interested in the legal question you raised is more of what you characterized as a policy question, but as a fact of what the law is in relevant areas. And I'm a yes on these amendments to raise the age of consent, but I wanted to have several questions, if I could, about
this. Please continue with your question.
So one is that point. I would think that would be useful to clarify this, to find out, you know, that statutory question. I believe that would what you will find. There was a reference earlier to she as the younger person. Is it accurate to say that the Alaska law of sexual abuse, sexual assault does not refer to gender?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, that's correct.
Right. So the person who was the younger person who had been assaulted or abused could be male or female. Yeah. Although my experience as a prosecutor say that the very substantial majority of the cases I have involved females.
Follow-up, Representative?
I do. Yes. I have the other question I had to ask was, I think it's real important or would be really helpful to lay out precisely how the so-called Romeo and Juliet exception works. That's a term sometimes used. It's the provision of law that refers to the different penalties or non-criminality, the lack of a crime of sexual penetration or contact of people based on closeness of age, if I'm making sense here. Could you describe how that works under current law and how to work if it was changed?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, if by Romeo and Juliet you mean a relationship, sexual relationships involving people who are close in age,
right.
The current sexual abuse of a minor statutes do account for that. They routinely, you'll see in those statutes, they have age differences that are prescribed, as well as other circumstances. For example, the age difference may not be focused on as much if the person who is abusing the other person is in the same household or occupies a position of authority. So the statutes do talk about circumstances and age both. I will say in this amendment on page 2, in section 4 there, so it's page 2, lines 6 through 10, the age difference would be 4 years. So the victim would have to be at least 4 years younger than the offender.
Follow up, just to clarify. That means, and actually someone else asked me this, a non-lawyer, said both under current law and under this proposal, asked this particular factual scenario, which I think it's useful to put on the record and get an answer, a legal response to. And we have an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old. Under current law, is there an exception to the law that makes it non-prosecutable for an 18-year-old to have a sexual penetration contract with a 14-year-old?
Just 1 second so I can do the math here.
Right.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, it's at least 4 years younger. So the person has to be, under current law, the person has to be 17 years of age or older, and the victim has to be 13, 14, or 15, and then there also needs to be that four-year age group difference.
Well, if the age difference is more than 4 years at the time, it then becomes prosecutable a crime. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair of Representative Groh, correct.
Okay. And follow up. Madam Chair, under this proposal, would that less than 4 year exception still apply? So it would just be moved upwards. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, correct. The age is moved up. So the person would have to be 17 years of age or older, and the victim had to be 13, 14, 15, 16, or 17, and there would need to be a four-year age difference.
Or less
to not prosecute, or more to prosecute. Correct.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Allen?
I don't know if I'm allowed to ask this, but I'm going to go ahead and try.
For the chair.
I want your opinion. I want to know what your department feels, if this is a good amendment, or are we going to create more loopholes? Are we going to create unintended consequences?
Do you want to take that? For the record, Angie Kemp, Criminal Division Director for the Department of Law. So the department's position on this is that we're neutral as to this particular statute. And I understand that you would, Representative Allard, excuse me, through the chair, would like more, but that's our position. We can certainly tell you in detail what we think that this piece of legislation does and what it doesn't do, but that's our position.
Follow up.
Could you please tell me what this legislation does and doesn't do?
You bet.
And I almost want to ask you if you can gear it towards the marriage law, if you can add that in there, if you know how sure. It would be connected. Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Allard. So as Ms. Schroeder has indicated, there's still an affirmative defense if folks are married. So if the circumstances presents itself, and that's true right now in statute. So this isn't a change that's being made by virtue of this amendment. So what this would do, though, is raise the age from so instead of it would apply to individuals 17 for if we're talking about section 4 of I'm sorry, make sure I have the right section. I don't mislead everybody. If we're talking about section 4 of the bill or the amendment, it would still require that 4-year age difference. It would just shift or capture, I'll say, more of the victims of the offense. So right now, the state could not charge sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree as it's currently listed under subsection A1 if the victim is 16 years old and the suspect is 20 years old. So what this would do is expand the scope of coverage to cover 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, but still require all of the other elements that are at play. So still require proof of sexual penetration, still require proof of that age gap that we would have to meet, and sometimes we do have to do the math on that, and still require a showing on all of the other same elements in this offense. So the only change would be expanding the scope of coverage. And that's true for most of these sections.
Representative Groh.
I have a follow-up based on Representative Allard's questions, and thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I think it's important to say that my point was not about the defense for. I always knew that married 16 and 17-year-olds could have sex without fear of prosecution for their spouses. What I was pointing out was that what you call the C7 policy point. Or the policy difference of allowing 16-year-olds to get married but having the age of consent at 18. That's what I was raising. But specifically, picking back off what Representative Allard raised, is the 4-year-old, sometimes I did not coin the term Romeo and Juliet. It was one that existed when I was, you know, a prosecutor back in the 80s and 90s. And but that, let's call it the age exception only, setting aside the special circumstances of authority that you earlier set out, Ms. Schroeder. Is the age difference calculated by year or by day? Let me make it as precise as possible. Sounds odd, but like I said, one person in particular was questioning me about this. Is it because someone can be 14 years old, 14 years and 11 months old, right? And another person, the other person can be 18 and 1 month old. So by years, they're more, you know, it's 4 years apart, but by actual days, it's not, if I'm making sense. So I ask how the law calculates that actual range.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Groh, to answer your question is, it does get down to days and does get down to figuring out if as baseline 4 years separate the two. Sometimes it's 4 years and a month. Sometimes it's 4 years and 2 months.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, maybe this is a stupid question, but what if there's an intervening leap year and they had the same birthdays? So would there then be an additional day? Or I mean, I don't know. Right. I mean, there would have actually been an additional day, right?
Right.
It was part of the year. So
through the chair, Representative Sumner, thank you. That actually is not a stupid question and would require a calculus by us to make sure that that element is met. Because again, it's an element that we have to meet beyond a reasonable doubt. So if it's that close in age, that may be something that a prosecutor might say to themselves, holy smokes, I'm not sure I can prove this element beyond a reasonable doubt because of this dynamic here. So this is the floor for charges as far as that element goes. And then of course, it can be more than that. But it would come down to that minutia, potentially.
Vice Chair Eller.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So if I'm 17 and I meet a boy, he's 21, he can go to jail.
In that hypothetical, if you meet the boy and you engage in sexual penetration, because those are the other, of course, sexual penetration is the other element, but to your point, through the chair, Representative Allard, yes.
Follow up.
What if I'm 17, I've graduated from high school, I'm going off my freshman year, it's September, and I meet a boy who's 21 and we're going to school here in Alaska. Can he still go to jail if I'm not under the management of my parents anymore?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, again, with that hypothetical, in those facts, without anything, any more information, then I think the answer is still yes.
Madam Chair, I can't support this amendment then. Thank you.
Further questions from committee members? I have a question. This is a big change in policy from what the state has continually done, and what would be the impact to your department if we were to adopt this amendment?
Thank you, Chair Vance. I assume that by impact you're asking fiscal impact or workload impact or both.
Workload impact. What's the effect? I mean, obviously, it wouldn't just be someone having a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old having a relationship, but there would be someone making a report to the troopers, things like that. Are these the types of cases that you see that you're having to turn away and say, well, under the law, you know, you're going to be treated, we're going to deal with this accordingly? I want to know what that impact's going to be, the impact for your division to handle. Yeah. Are there going to be a lot more cases? Like, what's the impact overall to the division and then also to public safety?
All right. Thank you, Chair Vance. I'm going to try and break that question down just a little bit. So to answer the first part of your question, what impact as far as caseloads, how it will affect our caseloads, it's at this point, quite honestly, not possible to tell because what it's expanding to coverage that's otherwise not criminalized right now. So it's taking a scope or a subset of circumstances that isn't at this point criminal. So when we get cases, of course, as maybe folks remember from the budget presentation, for those of you who are here, we rely on law enforcement to send us the referrals. So it is, we wouldn't be getting likely referrals in most instances where it was a 17-year-old, to use Representative Allard's example, a 17-year-old having sex with a 21-year-old, because it's not criminal conduct unless there are other elements and other factors at play. So it's assuming things that we don't have the answer to right now. However, there is a subset of cases where we do engage in this calculus that Representative Sumner was getting at, which is it's so close to the margin of error in current law that we say to ourselves, I think that in order to, that we can't prove that element beyond reasonable doubt. So at this point, it's hard to measure what's not otherwise criminal as far as the effect and impact it may have. The best measurement that we have right now is our estimates that are I think, grounded primarily in HB 325 and some of the predictions that we made as far as caseload increases when you change the sexual assault definitions and without consent language. So, again, those are best estimates. And there's data that goes into that, but estimates from that data. I think the question you asked about resources and how it may affect prosecutions, we're going to do the best job that we're able with the resources. We believe there will be a fiscal impact that goes along with this piece of legislation for us, and likely without, I don't want to speak to other people's budgets, but there would be a fiscal impact to us. I can't tell you, as I sit here right now, in honesty, what that would look like ultimately, but it would be an impact, and there would be an increase in workload.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for either Casey Schroeder or Angie Kemp from members right now? Thank you so much. I do have a question for Department of Public Safety.
This is Lieutenant Robert French with the Alaska State Troopers.
Lieutenant French, we also have a lifeline here, Lisa Purinton, so this question can be for either one of you. As was previously mentioned, you were the first, the public safety is the first who would be reported of any crimes. And what would be the impact to public safety in being able to respond with this policy change?
For the record, Lisa Purinton, Division Director with Division of Statewide Services with the Department of Public Safety. To the Chair's question, very similar to what Ms. Kemp had referred to, this would be an increase in workload. As she had mentioned, this is an increase in the definition of some activities that are currently not criminal, and this would criminalize some of those activities when that age of consent is raised. And with that, we would have a number of investigations. These are felony-level crimes for the most part, and those do take a significant amount of time to investigate. So there would be a fiscal cost. And we were also doing a look back. We haven't dug into trying to identify numbers. To your question earlier of, do we get these reports that we just can't take the case because we don't have that age difference? I don't have those numbers. That stuff that we would be looking through to see if we have any of that information. And we would be doing the look back similar to, I believe Ms. Kemp had mentioned, was House Bill 325 when there was some similar changes, significant changes to the sex offense crimes. And so that's where it would be a projection on cost. But there would be an increase in workload and a fiscal impact.
For clarification, that was the consent bill from a few years ago, House Bill 325.
To the Chair, yes, ma'am.
Okay, just want to clarify, it's not a current
bill. Yes, thank you. Sorry.
So, because that was a major policy change, what was did that require more investigators?
To the Chair, yes, at that time, and I would have to go back in and look to see what the department has done since that bill was implemented with that fiscal note to see what the staffing levels changes were with the department, because I don't have that information at this time.
Okay, we do have a question from Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, and through the Chair, I don't know if you can answer this or if we're going to go back to Director Kemp and Casey. So my concern is that, and I've been thinking about this too, with 16-year-olds that are emancipated, that have already gone off to college at an earlier age, 17-year-olds that go off to college and leading their own lives, and this is going to be challenging. So I guess my question is, when you have a 16-year-old and they have been raped or sexually violated in any in that way, there are laws that protect them as far as them going to the police and doing it. This is just taking a 16-year-old, 17-year-old and throwing them or anybody under 18 and putting them in with a child area. Am I right on that? Am I understanding that correctly? There's a different law that pertains to a minor versus someone we wouldn't consider a minor in that instance.
Through the Chair to Representative Allard, if that's the legal question, I would defer to the Department of Law just to make sure that they provided the specific legal ramifications of that situation.
Do you have any more public safety questions?
No, and I apologize. No, thank you. I think I'm good.
Thank you.
Wait, before you leave. In the consent bill 325, there were this issue came up as a consideration because of wanting to protect young people with treating them as minors from the age of 18, no matter what. I should remember, I was a part of that committee with this. Do you remember why, at some point along the process, it was probably outside of my committee, that this area of law did not pass in that consent bill? Do you recollect?
To the chair, I'm afraid, ma'am, I don't.
Do you know what the impact, not necessarily the fiscal impact, but how many investigators are needed to be able to sustain this change?
To the chair, if I'm correct, and I will definitely clarify with you, I believe the fiscal note that was submitted at that time for those for HB 325 from the 2022, not current, that was, I believe it was 7 investigators.
Okay. Thank you so much. Vice Chair Allard, did you have
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
In wrap up, thank you, Madam Chair. So to think a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old has the same maturity as an 18-year-old is fanciful. Those are formative years, and we allow older adults to prey on those kids' lack of maturity and standing. Those folks often don't own their own car, they don't have their own money, they don't have a credit card, a minor can't be held accountable to a contract. Even the most confident teen will not show the same confidence with adults that they do with their peers. Earlier, just a few months ago, there was a case involving a 63-year-old state trooper who had pulled over a minor while she was driving, and then he started exchanging text messages with her. When her father found out, he contacted law enforcement. They set up a sting operation, and they were able to apprehend him and charge him because he was in a position of authority, because he was a trooper. If this man had been the father's friend, a mom's boyfriend, then it wouldn't have been a crime. It would not have been a crime. This bill, this amendment would change that. We're talking a lot about human trafficking in this meeting, in this committee. And in regards to human trafficking, 16 and 17-year-olds are inherently more vulnerable than adults. A potential sex trafficker can have a 16 or 17-year-old say that they consented to sexual activity. They can convince the 16 or 17-year-old that they are consenting to sexual activity. This is an enormous loophole that sex traffickers can drive right through. I also want to just say about the fiscal note and about hiring people, what I'm hearing is that we have crimes currently occurring, in my opinion, that are not being investigated, and the state is saving money. And I just think that I can't imagine that we're going to try to balance our budget and have a more balanced budget by not going after criminals, by not making this a crime, by not trying to enforce what I believe is best for minors. I called folks who work in this field. I called a lot of them. I asked them, what's the biggest bang for our buck in terms of preventing sexual assault, in terms of preventing sex trafficking? And what they said was, raise the age of consent. Raise the age of consent. That is a huge, huge problem in Alaska. And just to remind you, this would put us in line with Arizona, Idaho, Florida, Utah, North Dakota, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia. This is a good amendment. This is going to stop crimes. This is going to help people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Allen.
Madam Chair, I want to move to amend the amendment. Do a conceptual. Can I go ahead and do that, Madam Chair?
What is your conceptual amendment?
I Can we take just a brief at ease really quick, please?
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go ahead and forego doing an amendment to the amendment.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. So any final comments from members before we take action on amendment number 3?
We had wrap up already.
I apologize. No final comments from...
Will the...
On the amendment. Comments on the amendment.
Comments on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do.
Representative Johnson.
I wholeheartedly support the concept here, and I certainly do not want to encourage crime, but there's a lot we don't know. I think that by passing a bill that we may not be able to hire people to do, much less have the money for, and these are kind of very specialized law enforcement officers, so they're not just the run-of-the-mill trooper that you, and there's no such thing as a run-of-the-mill trooper, so I want to stand corrected. It's not something that a trooper you just bring in and does. This is a very specific investigation. And in light of the lack of knowledge, I'm going to err on the side of not advancing something that we may not be able to hire the people for. It's less a money issue to me than it is. If it's on the books and we can't do anything about it because we don't have the people, it's tough for me to vote for right now. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And just to do a quick follow-up, Representative Johnson, I agree, because this isn't about funding for me. This is about unintended consequences, and I worry about what that could cause by an individual being 16 or 17. So for me, it's not about the fiscal. It's about the unintended consequences that can occur from this. So thank you.
Any further comments, Representative Groh?
I'm persuaded that this is good policy. I'm going to, on that basis, vote for it. And I think that to the degree that there are funding concerns, there are actually some legislators in this building who have some ideas about how we could raise some more funds to help address that, this and other problems. But I do think that Representative Gray is completely correct in that there's a lot of vulnerable young people, and that, as I said, based on my view of the right policy, I'm going to vote yes.
Any further comments by members? Representative Carpenter.
Yep, I think I'm not ready for this. I have questions, and in that regard, I'm not ready to move off of current policy. It's not being promoted by the administration saying that it's necessary. I can make a judgment call on that, but that would require some additional questions to be asked, and we're at the stage now where we're deciding whether we're going to pass this amendment or not, and I'm not prepared, so I'm a no until I am prepared.
Thank you. I would just like to state that I am for raising the age of consent. I think it's the right thing to do. However, there are I think this is a bigger change than what we're seeing and putting on the record at this time. And I think that's highly important because the change requires a very clear legislative intent. And I have a lot of concerns. I want to support this. However, I feel that our investigators that within our departments don't have the capacity. And I think that puts everyone in a very tough position. I am interested in having a further conversation about this at another time. It is a very worthy topic that I think we need to have a lot more voices at the table on this issue so that we can fully understand the impact. So I am unable to vote on it today. Will the recorder please call the roll on amendment number 3? At ease. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Final wrap up. My understanding of the fiscal note's about $3 million and that it's 7 staff members. And I'll just keep note that we have agreed that that's too much to protect our young people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray, I think you have mischaracterized what each of the members have said. And that is an abuse of the liberty that I just gave you. And it will not happen again. Will the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Sumner.
No.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Groh.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
No.
Chair Vance.
No.
2 yeas and 5 nays.
By a vote of 2 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment Number 3 has failed to pass. Representative Groh, Amendment.
I'm not going to offer that amendment right now.
Thank you. And let me see where we are. Representative Gray, Amendment Number 5.
I will not be offering that amendment at this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That concludes the amendments that we are prepared to take up on House Bill 67 at this time. We are now going to set this bill aside and take it up again on Monday. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Monday, February 12th at 1:30 p.m. to continue on our work on House Bill 67 by the governor and consider bills previously heard and scheduled. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 2:35 p.m.